Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Talking today with Andy Mia. He's the author of Genetically Modified Athletes, and he's a lecturer in media, bioethics, and cyberculture at the University of Paisley. Yes, there is a University of Paisley in Scotland, UK. Welcome, Andy.
Hi.
Now, I know that your phone has been ringing off the hook because this topic of gene doping and doping of athletes in general has been taking off. And so congratulations for that you're finally getting the attention for your work that you have deserved. This is a wonderful book, and it comes to some surprising conclusions. And we were talking earlier about the fact that most of the coverage doesn't get beyond the technical feasibility. But let's get that out of the way. The technical feasibility of gene doping. Is there any gene doping happening right now? And what kind of gene doping do you see in the near-term horizon?
Well, this is always the first question that journalists are interested in, actually. They always want to know, is it going to be at Athens? When is it going to actually be possible to do this? Now, the genetic scientists who know about this stuff claim that the science is feasible, and we know that there are animal models out there that have demonstrated increases in muscle mass through gene transfer technology. And so those sorts of applications are potentially the sort of applications that athletes could use. So the response from scientists is that it's feasible. The technology is available, but what we don't have are the scientific studies to show whether this will actually lead to any performance enhancement or not. And partly for that reason, that's why scientists say it's unsafe, don't do it.
What are some of the technologies that you see coming down the road?
Well, I think the most immediate ones, I mean, a guy, Lee Sweeney at the University of Pennsylvania, has done a lot of work on IGF-1, and this is looking at the way in which you can deal with muscular difficulty, so looking at something like muscular dystrophy and try to find some way of combating that disease. That sort of research is the kind of thing that's on the horizon for athletes. And in fact, that specific area of research, looking at IGF-1, is potentially what might be useful for athletes to use.
This has been huge in the last 2 weeks because there was this kid discovered in Germany who was like 2 years old and he had the muscles of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And they found that he had some kind of gene mutation that if we could give to people with muscular dystrophy, it might turn their disease around.
That's right. And actually, the Arnold Schwarzenegger label is one that's been attributed to Sweeney's work before. I remember a couple of years ago, he was branded with the Schwarzenegger mice, where their muscles were increased by 50% and so on. And what I find fascinating about it is the kind of language that arises from this prospect, the way in which this Frankensteinian monster is created, particularly in relation to sport. And the cover of my book has this very wonderful image by an artist called Daniel Lee, which is an image of an athlete who looks somehow morphed with a cheetah. And it creates this idea of some kind of transgenic monster, I suppose. And that's precisely what people imagine when they think about genetically modified athletes, which is a problematic issue. I mean, it's to suggest that these beings will be somehow radically different from you or I, it's just not true. I mean, most of the modifications that are likely in the near future won't lead to grossly deformed human beings. They'll lead to people that look very similar to you and I.
Well, one of the we've had an opportunity to talk about this before when you were in the States, and I remember one of the examples that came up was the Adidas, I think, a training facility that they've put together where they have super oxygenated or sub oxygenated environments that simulate what it's like to live in the Andes. And some human beings live in the Andes and some don't live in the Andes, and the ones who live in the Andes tend to have an advantage with their ability for stamina, I guess, when they compete in these kinds of events. And so if you can simulate that, you can. And why isn't that some kind of technological enhancement when gene doping is?
Well, and this is a very good example. These hyperbaric chambers, as they're called, are very much at the moment at the cusp of whether of being legal or illegal in sports. For most of the world, they're legal at the moment. In Norway, there are some prohibitions on the use of this technology. Now, you could argue that in Norway, you don't really need an altitude chamber. You're pretty high up anyway. But nevertheless, it's a useful example at the moment for the world of sport to look at, because with the altitude chambers, if you ask most athletes, they'll say there's nothing wrong with them. They're legal. They can help to alleviate some disadvantage for people living at a lower altitude. And so in that sense, they're somehow enhancing competition and making it fairer. But the moment that these technologies, this kind of technology in particular, becomes illegal, the athlete's response would change radically. And so one of the arguments that people make in relation to gene doping, and I'm concerned about this because gene doping has already been characterized as doping, and that's one of my major criticisms of how the discussion's evolved so far, is that I'm not sure that it's fair to conceptualize genetic technology as similar to drug use and other forms of doping. I think it's radically different. And so the point is that these things, whether these things are unacceptable or not, is basically determined by whether they're within the rules or not. So if gene doping was permitted by the World Anti-Doping Agency and the International Olympic Committee, then athletes probably wouldn't have much of a problem with it. And this actually, to me, seems like a much better way to go. I'm concerned that by making this illegal, that you push it underground, you make it very difficult for athletes to engage with the technology and understand the implications. It seems much better to me if we had a situation where athletes could know how to use this technology in a way that enhances their performance. Otherwise, you have people using it potentially with very significant risk.
This question of what's an enhancement and what's not an enhancement, of course, is rife throughout bioethical discussions of enhancement medicine to begin with.
Yeah.
And it has come up repeatedly in the doping controversies, because if you have a cold and you take cold medicine, then that can show up in your dope screen and you can get thrown out of a competition, whereas somebody else who doesn't have a cold doesn't get thrown out because they, you know. And so the whole question of what's doping and what's not seems kind of questionable from the get-go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I happen to think that the way in which I think we need to reappraise the entire basis of anti-doping, which isn't a very popular suggestion. But actually, if you look at the way in which anti-doping has evolved, it came out of the 1960s, partly as a result, well, largely, I think, as a result of athletes dying in the field. One of the key examples was Tommy Simpson's death in the 1967 Tour de France. And at that time, almost as a response to these sorts of situations, I might add that Tommy Simpson's death was televised as well, which I think is probably critical.
Here you had Ken Bias, I guess, who we had a basketball star who died of a cocaine overdose on the court. So that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's that sort of situation. I think people talk about the rationale, the ethical, the moral theory that underpins anti-doping. In the 1960s, anti-doping emerged out of the IOC when its medical commission was established with its specific remit to tackle the problem of drug taking and doping in sport. Now, if we go forward 30 years to 1998, Tour de France again, culture of doping, we saw lots of people on television who were being taken to prison for offenses in the Tour de France. This also gave rise to another big reaction in the world of sport, which was the development of the World Anti-Doping Agency. So it seems to me that two things come out of that. Partly is that the way in which anti-doping has evolved has been reactive, based upon quite paternalistic concerns about athletes killing themselves. But also we see it as being very much governed by quite conservative medical ethical principles. And one of the things I urge in relation to this topic is that the ethical foundation of anti-doping needs to look more critical literature in bioethics, medical ethics, to really take into account how its values, how the meaning of sport might have evolved, and also how our use of technology might have evolved as well.
Well, before I think that's a whole fascinating set of topics, and I want to get into it in a second, the whole meaning of sport. But before we go there, let me just explore this enhancement, non-enhancement distinction a little bit further. Mm-hmm. There is, to me, a whole bunch of technologies which will come to the fore in the next couple of years, it seems, which will protect athletes from the consequences of the grueling regimes and endurance feats that they put themselves through. You think of football. How many enhancements might we make to football players so that they don't end up crippled at the age of 40 after playing a life of professional football? Now, it may be that we're just enabling body torture, but if they're going to play football, I would want them not to be crippled. So if we could make their bones bones stronger, make their muscles stronger, make their skulls stronger so that they don't end up with 10 IQ points knocked off, as apparently lots of brain injuries do for soccer players and football players. That, you know, why would that be considered a doping or an unfair enhancement? Yeah. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it reminds me of how the American football helmet has evolved. And an article was published nearly 10 years ago, I think now, about the changes in the American football helmet from leather to plastic. And partly the rationale behind that was to make it a safer game. The researcher concluded that actually it led to athletes feeling much safer and uninhibited, and led to a much rougher game, in fact, and other sorts of injuries emerged. And so I think that the way in which sports utilize technology is very complex. It's not a straightforward situation, and that's partly why I argue that the anti-doping issue, the whole issue about performance enhancement, needs to look much, much more widely. If you look at how anti-doping's been developed over the last 40 years, and then look at how rules about equipment and other sorts of technology, they've been totally separate. And it seems to me that if anti-doping is supposed to be about fairness, about ethics, about the value of sport, then we need to look at other sorts of examples, other technologies that are constitutive of sport, and see how sports make sense of them. It's not clear that technology actually, we can understand how technology is going to affect sports. We have some consequences we can perhaps prepare for, but others we can't see. And so it's much more complex than is being dealt with currently in the World Anti-Doping Agency.
I'm speaking with Dr. Andy Mia. He's the author of Genetically Modified Athletes, and he's a lecturer in bioethics and cyberculture at the University of Paisley in Scotland. This whole idea of the philosophy of sport took me by surprise when I first ran across it a couple of years ago. But there is a whole literature out there of people trying to figure out what we mean by sport, and it comes into play in this debate. If we were, for instance, as some have proposed, and I think is a direction that you lean, if we were to create a non-enhanced and an enhanced league of sports, would that address people's concerns? Because it seems like one of people's concerns is that people should be on the same playing field, it should be a head-to-head competition, that welterweight should go against welterweight and heavyweight against heavyweight.
I think that has some value. One of the things that's interesting about the philosophy of sport is the exploration of all sorts of metaphors that arise in that context. So the notion of a level playing field, this kind of idea that's out there that seems to have some meaning for people. We need to take those to task. And yes, I mean, philosophy of sport, as you say, has quite an established body of literature now. It emerged in the 1970s, a similar sort of time as other sorts of applied disciplines in philosophy emerged as well. And so for 30 years now, it's had an established refereed journal looking at these ethical and philosophical issues that sport raises. The questions about the aesthetics of sport, violence in sport, gender equity, those sorts of ideas.
What we're constantly looking for, especially in the context of the Olympics, is to find people who do beyond the humanly ordinary. It's that, you know, no ordinary human being can do the things that anybody in the Olympics does.
Yeah.
And so then to say, well, yeah, but we don't want you to go too far beyond the humanly ordinary, and we don't want you to use these extra things out here that might make it possible for you to go even further beyond the human ordinary. And when you compete against somebody else, we want you both to have the same kinds of shoes, and we want you both to have the same kinds of musculatures. I don't understand where this whole idea of what fair competition comes from when it's all about trying to see how far the human body can go.
Well, I think sport is imbued with a lot of contradictions. It's certainly not the case that all sports use technology in the same sorts of way. So we don't seek standardization for everything, every form of equipment in sports. For skiing, for example, we might have different length skis depending on our body size and so on. So I think it's important that we make distinctions between how different sports use different forms of technologies. And this might go some way to helping us understand how technology should or should not be used in specific kinds of sports for specific functions. But I think that these contradictions are very relevant and very important to draw out, but partly because they lead to very significant injustices. To require an athlete to live in this situation of immense contradiction, they're on the one hand trying to enhance themselves, make themselves the best, but also having to restrain themselves in ways that are quite ambiguous often, and somehow inappropriate. I mean, the very basis on which we distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate methods of performance enhancement needs further problematization. It's not clear why some things are unacceptable and others are not. If we look at anti-doping specifically, as I say, this comes out of a very specific tradition of medical ethics. Anti-doping emerged out of a very paternalistic model of medical ethics where people were concerned about athletes dying. We're still in that situation. Scientists write to me and they're concerned about the kinds of arguments I'm making, partly because they say, well, athletes will kill themselves if they don't do this.
Well, there's this famous survey, I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about, where they asked a bunch of Olympic trainee athletes whether they would take some kind of dope that would shorten their lives, and a majority of them said they would if it would help their performance. Isn't that a legitimate concern?
Well, I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I think there's a bigger question that needs to be asked about this, and that's the level of paternalism that we're prepared to accept in our lives. And I think that partly the question about anti-doping is very much about the meaning of sport and what value it has. I mean, arguably, you could make a similar sort of conclusion about mountaineering. Mountaineering and actually boxing is a fantastic example. Ask any doctor about the merits of boxing.
It should be illegal.
I don't think it should be. I think that it very much is about the kind of risks that you want to take with your life. If I want to be a mountaineer and risk my life going up a mountain without any oxygen, without any backup, without a radio, then perhaps the kind of goods that I access by doing that, the kind of exuberance or excitement that I get out of that experience, and often climbing is a good example because people talk about the spiritual element of it, is somehow some very special experience. Well, should I be prevented from doing that? I don't think so. And in fact, mountaineering is also an example where we cherish those people that go up to Everest and come down having ascended the first route on a particular face. These are people who we exonerate and think are heroes in some way. So to say, well, this is dangerous, you shouldn't do this, I think that would eliminate something that's very valuable about human life.
One of the arguments that's used in Our Post-Human Future by Francis Fukuyama and by a lot of other bioluddite critics of human enhancement is that human enhancement technologies, and in particular they point to things like Ritalin or sometimes Prozac, that these technologies will rob us of the sense of achievement that we would have when we otherwise accomplish something without their use. And I always say, well, yeah, then that means that people who have diabetes shouldn't take insulin because they'll feel so much more of a sense of achievement if they just control their diabetes with diet. But isn't that one of the arguments here with sport? This is about not only other people's appreciation of your accomplishment, but about your own sense of accomplishment. And what we hope for from people is that they're in sports for their own sense of accomplishment, not just to prove something to somebody else.
I think that kind of argument's used in relation to a lot of other performance enhancements in sport. One of the things that I think, in part, there's something behind that argument that I think is absolutely true. If I wanted to be a mountaineer and I take a helicopter up to the summit, then clearly I'm not going through the kinds of processes that a mountaineer should go through in order to claim that they've achieved what a mountaineer claims to achieve to have done. I don't think gene doping or other forms of performance enhancement are like taking a helicopter up to the summit. I think they very often enable greater performances. They certainly don't negate the role of the human being in sport. So I don't see that genetic modification undermines or completely removes the role of the human being. I think it potentially can make it a much more interesting contest. I see it much more comparable to, oh, I don't know, new running shoes or a lighter tennis racket, that sort of thing, which enhances competition. It doesn't remove the human from it.
Speaking with Andy Mia, he's the author of Genetically Modified Athletes. He's a lecturer in media, bioethics, and cyberculture at the University of Paisley in Scotland. This is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J. Now, again, in the context of human enhancement, one of the questions that often comes up is unfairness and inequality between people. A lot of these technologies, when we think of the hyperbaric chambers, they're expensive and people in certain kinds of poorer countries wouldn't have access to them. And this will probably be true for some period of time with these enhancement technologies that we're talking about, genetic enhancements. That's one level of inequality and unfairness on the basis of money, that you have the best athletes money can buy. And then there's the inequality of the enhanced competing against the unenhanced. So can you talk about these two kinds of unfairness on the playing field?
Well, the idea of level playing field is also a tricky one. I think that I know a lot of people who work in elite sport and say there's nothing fair about elite sport. This idea is just ludicrous. People achieve their performances through all sorts of means, and to suggest that sport is about fair play is really pie in the sky. But let's suppose that there is some notion of fairness out there that we want to try to promote or maximize as much as possible in sport. Well, we could do that a number of ways. We could apply different notions of fairness that don't necessarily lead to banning genetic modification, don't necessarily lead to banning drug use and doping. And I want to make a distinction between those two, because I think drug taking has a very specific and more problematic history than other forms of doping. But fairness could be articulated in a number of ways. We could argue that, well, sport isn't fair in the sense that it doesn't permit people of different forms of body type to engage with it. We have different distinctions in certain sports, such as boxing, where we make some small distinctions between body weight and so on. But actually, sport is built for the elite human. It's built for the superhuman in very meaningful ways. You can't get to that position unless you have a very extreme physique and one that fits the sport specifically. So in that sense, it's already very much elitist. It's not about equity. It's not about enabling sport for everybody. Not everyone can be an elite sports performer. And I don't think that genetic modification necessarily makes it a more unfair playing field. I think that potentially it could make it a much fairer one, particularly given our current circumstances where the world of doping and the culture of doping within sport is so problematic and so contradictory. I find more sympathy with regulation of enhancements than the prohibition of them.
One of the issues that's been genetic issues that's come to the fore in the unfairness of competition has been the issues of females who are actually genetically male.
Yeah.
And whether they should be allowed to compete against females who are genetically female. Do you think that this has set some kind of precedent for this question? Again, it's a question of whether these extra genes, these male genes, give you an unfair advantage on the playing field.
Well, partly I think that that question actually requires responding to the entire context of modern sport as we know it, the separation of man and woman, and how that has led to certain inequities and certain ideological assumptions about what each can achieve. And I'm kind of pleased about the decisions that have been made recently, partly because I think it goes some way towards dealing with that problem. And we're nowhere near dealing with that problem yet in sport. We still see significant inequities between men and women in competition. And to suggest that there are biological differences that lead to significant differences between men's and women's achievements is also a bit of a fallacy. Sport is an artifice. It's a human construct. And so the measures that we employ, the measures by which we decide who's the fastest in the world or the strongest in the world, are constructed. And it seems to me that we could reconstruct those values, those systems, in a way that totally disrupts the male-female distinction.
It seems like you could make the same argument that for the separation of races, because there are certain kinds of characteristic lengths of legs associated with particular kinds of genotypes, and why should those people get to compete against people who don't have those kind of genotypes that you make for the separation of the genders?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, that we should just put everybody in the same pot?
Well, you know, it's not such a bad idea, and I think from an ideological perspective, it's not such a bad idea either. And the reactions of the World SWHC in relation to this issue is really critical. I mean, in the 1960s, gender verification tests were introduced, and you look through the archives of the Medical Commission of the IOC, and at that time, in the 60s, scientists, physiologists were saying, this is not acceptable. You cannot have this kind of test in sport. It's meaningless. It has no value. It has no scientific credibility. And it wasn't until Sydney 2000 when the IOC decided to stop testing for gender. And to realize that that's just 4 years ago, in fact, should really wake us up to the fact that sport is not some coherent ethical theory on what's right and what's wrong. It's much more complicated than that. And it's certainly ideological, and it certainly has a lot of inequities within it that need to be addressed. And part of the problem of these issues is that they haven't been addressed since anti-doping began. Anti-doping procedures and policies have not readdressed the values on which they're founded since they began. They come out and they still very much fall in line with quite conservative medical ethical principles. What we need in sport is a real mechanism to continually appraise what matters in sport. Continually appraise the foundation of anti-doping procedures and, more broadly, an ethical view on performance in sport.
Let's talk about solutions and proposals for ways to get around the kinds of censoriousness and authoritarianism that you're pointing your finger to. One proposal would be to create separate leagues. Now, I can see that happening in the private sector relatively easily. That, you know, we had recently the rise and fall of the extreme sports phenomenon. They had the extreme football league. I'm sure that we could have a genetically enhanced football league at some point, where if those kinds of enhancements were legal for people to do at all. Where it becomes political and much more high profile is the question of the IOC. Would you recommend to the IOC that they either stop testing or start using testing to differentiate between enhanced and unenhanced athletes?
Let me start with the separation of competitions. It's not clear quite what this would lead to. Arguably, would lead to us if we had the enhanced against the unenhanced. If we had the enhanced separate from the unenhanced, then the unenhanced, people competing in the unenhanced might still actually try to cheat and gain an advantage over their competitors.
You'd still have to have testing.
Yeah, I think you would. And I'm just not sure that testing is the best mechanism. I'm not, while I'm critical about the World Anti-Doping Agency and the IOC, I can sympathize with their position. I think they're, just this year they've included a prohibition on gene doping.
If anything, they're getting more rigid.
I think they're certainly getting more rigid, and certainly at this very moment, they're getting more rigid. And in the U.S., the recent discussions about lowering the burden of proof is some indication of that, which is partly a reaction to how doping cases have gone through the courts. And certainly many of them have been very difficult for anti-doping policymakers to take very far. And so positive doping cases seem to be very difficult to follow through and ban people from competition. Now, whether you think that's a bad thing or not, I think it's a complicated issue. Potentially, this is a good thing. I think that the policies that underpin the legal status of doping and anti-doping programs is questionable. I think that it's wrong to demonize athletes just because they take something, they might have some minute substance in their body, partly which might have been argued as being without their knowledge anyway. This notion of a strict policy, strict liability that works within sport, again, it's a pragmatic decision, but it's not an ideal system by any means.
Okay, last minute question here. Given everything that you've said, isn't it still the case that it would be a better regime for all of the drugs that people have and all of the modifications that they're doing to be out on the table so that we can know if people are hurting themselves and who's competing against who and on what grounds, and for us to permit some kind of genetic modification, especially when it's for enhancement purposes and not harmful to people's health?
I think if you look at the genetic modification issue, most definitely. We're in a situation where athletes don't know what's possible, scientists aren't too sure what's possible, and so there are all sorts of speculations about what this technology might achieve. If athletes knew that the gene doping possibility would actually lead to killing themselves or really hurting themselves seriously and wouldn't actually have any consequence for their performance, they probably wouldn't do it, and quite rightly they wouldn't do it. So to make them aware of this is critical. We haven't had that knowledge with other forms of drug taking and doping in sport, and I think that's really a problem. It doesn't lead to a better situation.
Andy, I really want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Andy Mia. He's the author of Genetically Modified Athletes, and you can find that at any bookstore and online. And he's a lecturer in media, bioethics, and cyberculture at the University of Paisley in Scotland. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.